Hospitalitychain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, Hospitalitychain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace. Hey, welcome back to another episode of the Fell Into Food Podcast. Today, I'm really excited because I've got Chris Stein on the show. Chris is the corporate innovation chef at Breakbush and has such a cool background. He went from studying biology to becoming a food scientist, and now he's doing some crazy innovation stuff in the food world. We're going to dive into all of that and talk about how science and cooking come together to create the foods we all love. Plus, we'll get into some trends, behind-the-scenes chef life, and even a few surprises along the way. All right, that's enough for me. Let's get into the conversation.
I mean, it's been months now since we were actually talking. And
I know.
You know, kind of obviously know the background, but not, like, everything's not fresh in my mind. You know, I was super excited when I just saw, you know, biology degree and then food scientist turned traditional chef. I was like, wait a second. This is not a normal, quote unquote, chef. So, like, tell me, what was it like going, I guess, getting a biology degree, or what was the original intent? Like, what did you want to do in life? And then what led you into food science?
Yeah. I mean, I was always super excited about science. I loved science. So I thought, like, I'll pick a path of science that I might be interested in. I thought I might end up like saving animals or something like that. Which is kind of, you know, why I went the biology route. But things kind of changed because I'd always been super passionate about cooking and food, and it was a hobby. And it was really my last semester of college. I had a professor who had recently joined the school, and he was like, dude, have you ever thought about food science? And I was like, no, because I have no idea what that is. So it sounds like something cool. I'd love to know more. And he's like, hey, I got this idea. Like, I've got a friend who is a food scientist. Why don't you meet her and just talk to her and kind of learn about like what she does? So we ended up spending time together at the Great Taste of the Midwest, so the big beer fest in Madison that like everybody travels for, and spent a day with her. And I was just like, holy cow, this is like, this job sounds amazing. Like, I would love to do this, but I'm like getting ready to graduate. So what do I do? And right. She's like, just go, like, see if you can find a job, get your foot in the door somewhere and just go from there. She's like, you know, if that doesn't pan out, maybe go back and think about getting a master's or something like that. But at least start with the easy approach, like try to find work. And that's what I did. Found a job in the food industry, like starting in R&D, and just absolutely fell in love with it. So I knew I was in the right place. Like, I knew the food industry was where I wanted to be. I had spent time working in restaurants, like when I was in college. And mm-hmm. I think I learned a very valuable lesson that like that lifestyle probably wasn't sustainable for me. So this was a really cool opportunity to still stay connected to the food and the industry, but in a little bit different way. So I just, you know, kept building my skills on the technical side, like learning more about food science and R&D, but could never really kick that just passion I had for the cooking side, and knew that I wanted to migrate that direction. So in kind of a tough spot, though, like it's hard to go back to school while you're working, and I didn't want to give up my job. So that's really when I learned more about the Research Chefs Association and the opportunities that they had with the certifications that they offer, where I could blend the two things together. So, you know, did coursework. Got to like take classes out in Napa and learn, you know, the culinary stuff in a little bit different way, like on a work schedule, and ended up getting my certification as a certified culinary scientist through them. So that's really where like I think the crux of like the two things meeting happened. And then I just really pushed, you know, in my career to get embedded more in the culinary side of things, and then eventually, you know, shifted a little bit more that direction. But the reality is it's always a balance of the two. I think I've been able to do what I do as a chef because I have this root in the food science part that kind of keeps me grounded to what it is that we're trying to do, because we're not going in and cooking dinner at a restaurant every night. Like, we're trying to make food products for millions of people. And, So it's just a little bit different dynamic, but you know, still connected to the food and the science that way.
Yeah. So what it does, because food science was something I was actually gonna like. So when I went to school, I was actually thinking about it of like, oh, maybe I go back and get my food science degree. Is there an actual degree, or do you just get, you know, certified through like ACF or like you said, the Research Chefs Association?
Yeah, there are absolutely food science degree programs. A lot of the folks that I have worked with and work with currently all apparently were enlightened in a way that I was not, because they knew about it and I just never did. And in fact, I would say too, in the last, 10, 15, 20 years, we've seen an increase in actual culinology programs. So universities and colleges who are having programs specifically designed around blending food science with culinary arts. So I think I just saw recently, I think Iowa State just started their program, got that approved. So it's not only do we have the food science, and that's been around for years. In fact, I had a boss, you know, years ago, I think she got her degree in like the 80s. So like, it's been around that long and I just wasn't privy to it. But there are now degree programs that offer both of those things together, which I think is awesome.
Yeah. So, okay. You know, when I think food scientists, my typical, you know, go-to is, okay, they play in the lab, which probably is true to some degree, but what does that look like from a real life application, right? Like you got your foot in the door and you're doing kind of R&D, but what is it that like the kind of purpose of a food scientist? So that way anyone listening kind of knows, okay, this is what an actual food scientist does.
Yeah, that's a great question. And it's an interesting one, because I think there are also a lot of different paths you can take just within food science. So, you know, maybe largely because of my passion always for the culinary side of things, I always found myself doing, you know, applications food scientists, where it was developing product formulas and actually trying to create new items and concepts and bringing those things to life. But there are other directions you could take. I mean, there are people who have, you know, very strict chemistry backgrounds who are really interested in like the molecular and the chemical reactions and things that happen, where they're actually developing like flavors that we would put into finished food products. There are people who go down the path of, you know, food safety and quality, who might be more microbiology inclined, and, you know, they're looking at like preservation systems and how do we keep things, you know, safe and intact through the channels that we have to, you know, send food through. So even within the discipline itself, there's a few different paths that you could take, kind of depending on where your interests might lie.
Huh, that's interesting. So yeah, so there's probably a lot of those guys and gals in this industry that probably have no passion for food, like not in the sense of like cooking it all day. They have that yeah, biology or chemistry, and they just love doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I laugh at that, because I have worked with people in my past where they ended up as food scientists. Like I worked with them in the lab, but they literally said like, this could be anything to me. Like, I just love science. Like my previous job was working on, you know, tires or light bulbs or something like that. Like,
interesting.
There are in fact folks who like the food, you know, and I chuckle at it, I think, because, and you'll probably, you know, understand and appreciate this, like for people who are passionate about the food side, I look at that and I just go, how could that be a thing? Like, how would you not be excited about the food? But for some, it really is just the science, and it's just maybe more of a more fun medium that they get to play with science in than some of the other things. But yeah, they are actually able to kind of separate the two, which I always thought was kind of interesting.
So now that you're more in like a traditional, I don't even want to say traditional, because you're a corporate innovation chef. And again, I've had a lot of more corporate type chefs on to really explain what they do. And I'm really excited to talk about like your current company, Breakbush, because it's a company that no one has even heard of for the most part, right? If you're the general public, they're like, I don't know who Breakbush is. Yet they eat your food and products probably almost every day. They know the competitor really well,
absolutely,
but not who Breakbush is, which is so interesting.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, and that's, I think, primarily because we don't have a retail presence. We don't have our brand out on the grocery store shelves. Breakbush did years and years and years ago, you know, before I ever came along. And that's just kind of, things have shifted so aggressively towards really the food service and, you know, national account stuff that we support, that there really isn't room for, you know, a specific retail brand at this time. I think I would love to see us go that direction for sure, but it's just not where we are today. So yeah, for sure. You know, it's we don't have the brand recognition like some of the competitors that you mentioned. have, but yeah, it's when you say traditional, like I don't know what that means anymore. Like,
well, yeah, because you know, when someone says chef or they think restaurant, they hear traditional, right? Like, talk about the, you know, I think about like those that are in culinary school now. Maybe it's changed. I mean, it's been a good 10 plus years since I graduated. I went when I was late, in my mid-20s. Yep. But it was fine dining, catering, hotels, that kind of scene. And that's what I think a lot of people think of or when they hear. Because the first question I get asked all the time is, oh, so you cook all the time? And I'm like, actually, I don't do a ton of what you're envisioning of wearing a hat and being in the back of the house of a kitchen. I'm now doing a lot. I do consulting. And so I kind of, I'm my own little scientist in my own world, in the dry aging world. I'm learning all about that space and how the science behind it, which is fascinating. And again, I guess like deep down, like I said, I wanted to be a food scientist because I love experimenting and seeing what happens to food. And I just do it at more of maybe a dumbed down level versus what's happening at the molecular level. I'm trying to do that, but I don't have that kind of background, so I'm doing the best that I can.
Yeah, and I think that's a kind of interesting differentiator, and why I said earlier, like, I don't want to take anything away from, you know, the flavor chemists who are super important, because they're doing all that molecular work and doing some stuff that's way out of, like, way beyond my bandwidth. But yeah, I think I always kind of say, like, it's kind of a joke, but, you know, we're not in the kitchen cooking for, you know, 200 people a night. We're in a kitchen developing products for millions of people. Mm-hmm. And it's such a different approach, because, you know, to your point, you know, there's chefs in the industry that have all different amazing backgrounds, like work for Michelin starred restaurants. They work for different hotels and all these great things. And, you know, you can make an amazing plate of food that one time and give somebody the experience of a lifetime. We have to try to give people an experience every single day. And we have to develop products that are consistent. They are quality, you know, they're safe, they're repeatable. And that's really where the science and the culinary components meet, I think, is, you know, we have to go through different processes and procedures to develop a recipe, to develop a product that can be scaled and then taken to restaurants so that they can execute it the way that it was meant to be, the same every single time. And there's a lot of work that goes into doing that. And it's not just like, hey, I wrote a recipe for this thing. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit more complex than that. So,
And maybe, I guess we should take a step back and explain who Breakbush is. I mean, we said it in passing, sure. And obviously, again, most of the three know who it is, but just high level, who is Breakbush?
Yeah, so I mean, we're a further processor of poultry products. We do chicken. Chicken is all we do. That's kind of been a tagline over the years. And to your point, like, despite the recognition, I mean, we're going to be celebrating our 100-year anniversary next year. Super proud of that. I mean, it's an amazing family that runs an amazing company. Our products are, to your point earlier, in all kinds of different places. It may not be the grocery store shelf, but we are in, you know, pretty much every food service outlet you can imagine. Mm-hmm. We do work with pretty much every, you know, chain account that's out there. So we have a much broader reach than you would expect. And it's funny too. I mean, even people that have been in the industry for a long time, we still find people who are a little bit new to Breakbush and who we are. So.
So what does it look like? I know from a non-commercial side what it's like working, and I got to give a shout out to Patty. So if you're listening, Patty, thank you for the initial connection, because she's a pit bull and I love her to death and everything she does and has done. But what's it like working, you know, with like a national account, and like, how do they come? Do they come to you and say, hey, we want a spicy chicken and we want this exact profile? What does that even look like?
Yeah, I mean, it can happen in a couple different ways. I mean, one, just like you mentioned, you might have an account who is specifically looking for, they have a pretty good handle on what it is that they want. Spicy chicken breast fillet, let's say, for a sandwich. And then they'll come to us saying, this is the idea that we have. What can you help us with? How can you get us there? And it can also happen too, where they have no idea what they want. And they come to us and say, you know, we think we have a gap on this menu. Help us kind of analyze that and take a look at where opportunities might lie. What do you think we should have? So you can kind of attack it from a couple different angles. But really, yeah, then it's, I mean, once you identify what it is that you're actually trying to achieve, then it's, you know, that's where the rubber meets the road and you say, okay, like this is where you bring in, you know, different insights, like from a flavor perspective, like what is the market kind of dictating? What are they looking for? Again, what is that gap that we're trying to fill? And then how does our technology and our processes fit that gap? And then, you know, where the two come together, I think is where you find a solution. And then it's about making it make sense for them, making it make sense for the consumer, so that everybody's, you know, satisfied with what we came up with.
So then what does your day-to-day kind of look like within your own role? Because there's so many different ways that corporate chefs, and yours is more innovation. What is it like? Everyone wants to know, like they always hear high level or, oh yeah, I work with customers and I do this. What does it really look like on a day-to-day? And it could be a lot of minutia. Don't get me wrong, all jobs have that, but what is
A
day in the life of Chef Chris?
Yeah, I think, the best way I can describe it is I kind of try to envision like a triangle, and I live somewhere in between sales, marketing, and R&D. So a lot of what I do is supporting product development. You know, I think where we as culinarians have a significant impact is you have a food scientist who's trying to develop this product, and they might say, you know, oh, it's good, but like, it's just maybe missing something, or it's just like, doesn't have that thing that sets it apart from something else, or, you know, whatever it might be. And that's where I think the culinary influence comes in, and you say, oh yeah, what it's missing is like this note that it would get, like if you roasted chicken and it had drippings rendered and it was caramelizing fat and all of these things. And you say, well, let's think about how we can get those elements built in to really, you know, round out this product and give it a little bit more robust flavor profile. So I think we impact the product development in that way, because we just offer a little bit of a different approach and angle. We see things a little bit differently than somebody who's just like, hey, I need to make this that has XYZ, check the box and move on. So I think we add nuance to the product development process. You know, where we support sales is working directly with customers. Like we're the ones that are kind of bridging the gap between here's the product that we've created. Well, now I want to take it in and show it to you, show you how it impacts your business, how it works in your kitchen, how it would work on your shelf and wherever it's going to end up. And I think that's where, again, we come in and bridge the gap between sales and R&D and say, well, I can explain why we did this and, you know, how we got there and why it's important. And then we're that kind of liaison to help push it to the next step. And then marketing, I think, is the same way. We support them in terms of how we portray our products to consumers. It's, you know, we support a variety of social media efforts. We do different recipe development. We, you know, take pictures, photo shoots, you know, the different POS materials that we actually supply to people. We make sure that, you know, the information on there is reflective of the product and accurate. So we have all these touch points, and that stuff is just constantly, you know, there's no day that's, no 2 days that are the same, because it's just what are the needs of today? Like what customer's asking for what, like what product do we have to work on? So there's all those things. And that's all the stuff that's really, you know, I guess directly impactful to our external customers. And then I would say, you know, we also have internal customers, especially being a family, you know, owned company. We support a lot of internal efforts. Like if we do have customers in, we're often doing like lunches or, you know, just kind of highlighting our products in a little bit, you know, like nicer application or a little bit different way. We're also supporting efforts, like if we have meetings or something with the board of directors, like we're often the ones that are helping prepare meals for them so they can just kind of focus on business. So it's all over the place, and that's what keeps it fun and interesting, I think, because it's so dynamic and it's always changing. It's rarely boring, I can say that.
How many of you are there? Like how many culinarians does it comprise of for your guys' team?
Yeah. So up until about a year and a half ago, it was just one. So Breakbush historically had just a corporate chef. And we understood that there was more opportunity. And, you know, to my earlier point about, I think the direction of the industry kind of heading to this blending of food science and culinary arts, we brought on a culinologist. So I have a person who works for me in our culinary team that actually got one of those culinology degrees that I was talking about. So she actually was able to go to school and study both food science and culinary arts. So yeah, I joke like we've doubled the culinary team at Break Bush. It took 98 and a half years or whatever it was, but yeah, it's great to have another person for sure. I mean, it's sometimes you can feel like on an island, and so she helps keep my mental health in check sometimes too, I think.
Well, it's good just to have someone to bounce ideas off of, right? To throw stuff exactly on the wall rather than just trying to throw it at a wall and see what sticks for the board or for this person or that person, but to really like have good candid banter back and forth and be like, you're an idiot. No, why would we do that? Or wait a second, you're onto something, but you have that soundboard that allows you to do that when you have another person. Whereas, you know, if you're one man, woman show, it's kind of, you internalize and say, this is a great idea. And then I'm sure you've had it happen where you present and then it's like, wah, wah, wah. And they're like, no, that's not at all what we wanted. And you're like, oh, damn. Well, back to the drawing board.
Yeah. I mean, I think we've all, as product developers, had the thing that we thought was a home run that we sent out and turned out to be a total dud. And we've also had the things that were like, there's no way this is ever going to be a thing that people love and turn out to be, you know, the home run. So it's kind of crazy how that all happens, but you're so right. I can often gauge the quality of an idea based on her reaction, because like she'll immediately let me know if it's good, bad, or otherwise. So it's nice to have that.
Yeah. And because we're talking innovation and you've been in this space for quite some time now, you know, I think you said it was 2016 when you, or 2006 migrated to culinary. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you've been in this for quite a while. What have you seen from an innovation standpoint? And I have to bring it up because it was something that blew my mind. And I don't think a lot of people appreciated it in the industry when it happened, but when you guys went from CO2 to nitrogen, and maybe explain what it was and what you guys did and why it was game changing. Again, maybe I'm just a nerd and thought, oh my God, I literally said to Patty, I go, that's the smartest thing I've ever heard. Why wouldn't anyone ever do that before?
Yeah. So I'm fascinated by the fact that you're fascinated by this. And I'll be honest with you, I'm not sure that maybe I wasn't fascinated enough, because I remember us going through this process. I remember this happening, and you know, part of it was like, that doesn't really have anything to do with me. Like, I'm over here cooking chicken. Like, but you're so right. This was a very significant change, and I actually had to do a little bit of digging, and I had to. So we have a whole team at Breakbush, continuous improvement. Like, they are just some of the smartest people that you will ever find yourself around, like very engineering minded. They are all about, you know, efficiency and optimization and making sure things run the best that they absolutely can. So I've had some really cool conversations with those guys because they just like, they operate on kind of a different plane, I feel like. But they're the ones that really, I think, spearheaded this effort. And it was a function of the pandemic. CO2 just became in short supply. Like, we just couldn't get enough to support our processes. And so we had to start looking at other things. And that was the shift that we made, was switching from CO2 to nitrogen. I guess to touch on what you said earlier, like, why haven't people done this before? I mean, I think part of it was, you know, it's just the way that we've done things. Like, CO2, I think, is typically a little bit easier to work with. So it's more accessible. It just doesn't have as many challenges. But, you know, we have, like I said, some amazing folks working for us who figured out, like, we can make this change. And yes, it requires some effort. Like, I know we had to make capital investments. We had to do things a little bit differently. But that's why you have people that are 100 times smarter than you figuring that out. And that's what they did. And so it's been, you know, by all accounts, amazing ever since. It alleviated the problem that we had. And in fact, I think it's also uncovered, it's allowed us to do some things that that's probably the part that I don't want to get too, you know, deep into. But I think by switching that process, it's allowed us to do some different things, because the two substances function a little bit differently. And so we've had to modify some processes, and for the better. We learned a lot by making the change. And I think it's opened up some different avenues for us. So,
and just again, high level, that CO2 or nitrogen is what kind of powers being able to cut the chicken, right? Isn't that what it, you know, the actual function of the gas?
it's all about it's chilling. So I mean, we're using it as a cooling mechanism. Yep.
Yeah.
And so, you know, not to get like I don't understand the chemistry nearly as well as those guys do anyway. So I'm not going to pretend. But you know, those two things they cool at different rates and at different temperatures, and so they just function a little bit differently. But they both serve the same purpose. So yeah, we do. You know, like if we do ground products, for example, like we have to chill that product down really fast to get it to function in the system. So that's where that piece is so integral, because it's, I mean, it just has to happen. And so, you know, staring at we can't get enough CO2, like just isn't acceptable. Yeah. Because we can't do business without it, frankly. So, yeah.
Well, when I was in the space, you know, we couldn't even get CO2 for soda machines. And I go, if we can't get it for soda machines, the big guys can't get it for soda machines. What is this going to do to the industry? And that's when Patty kind of, you know, when things could be said was like, we're switching some systems. Just wait. You're going to see a fill rate that's going to skyrocket. And I was just like, that's why my mind was blown. I'm like, from a supply chain standpoint, this makes complete sense. And now you're not dependent on what everybody else is using. So it was just an innovation thing that I thought was really, really cool, and how, you know, manufacturers are kind of adapting. You know, what else have you seen over, you know, your time in, it could be the meat section, it could be in other sectors, but what innovations have you seen in the sector or what you deal with?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough question. I think mostly because, so much of my existence on this side of at least in my role at Breakbush, like I started 6 months before COVID happened. So the shift has, despite the fact that innovation is in my name, we've had to really adjust how we approach innovation because, you know, I'm sure you can appreciate a lot of restaurants for the last several years have been really in survival mode. It hasn't really been about, can I come up with the next great thing? They were just worried about keeping the doors open. And so it hasn't really been until the last, you know, year and a half, I would say, that I've felt a pretty serious shift away from this, like, I'm trying to keep my head above water. And now we can start finally looking at some interesting stuff. But that's all. I mean, I think we're still in that boat. Like everybody's trying to figure out what's that thing that's going to set them apart or, you know, keep folks coming in. So it's all about, like, especially now, like I feel like it's gotta be almost tailored for social media. Like people want the thing that's Instagrammable or can, you know, they want to talk about it. They want to show people, you know, like I just saw yesterday, this Whopper at Burger King that has the purple bun for the Addams Family. I mean, it's like stuff like that where like, it's got like, I haven't had it. I'm still talking about it because I saw it and it's like, holy cats, like that's interesting. I think it's that, like people are looking for those differentiators and it can come in a couple different ways. I mean, I think people are looking for unique flavors. So we're always exploring that. I mean, we're looking for, you know, what's like the next big flavor? What's the next big flavor combination? What's that thing that's going to make something unique and special? It could be just, you know, visually, how does this thing look? Like, how does it, you know, you got like, not to like harp on Burger King, but they just got like the big ranch cup to dip a Whopper in. So it's like, is it innovation in the sense that like they came up with something completely off the wall and different? No, it's a big cup of ranch, but it's like, it's all over social media and people are talking about it. So like, you got to respect the innovation in that way too. So
yeah, eyeballs and clicks. That's what it takes, you know? And again, from a consumer standpoint, what innovation is and what we think of innovation are two completely different things. They're not as pervy to seeing stuff that we're used to seeing on a regular basis in the industry. And you're like, oh, well, we've been doing that for a long time, but the public see it and go, ooh, that's new. Where it really isn't, it was just more of a behind the scenes, not a retail type deal or thing, you know, until a national chain or somebody big comes out with it and says, hey, look what we did. And we're just like, that's nothing. You know, kind of staying in that with a flavor standpoint, what are the flavors you're seeing? You know, I think a lot of global fusion is starting to really kick in, or that's what the American palate, I think. This was the first year I read a report, I could be wrong, that said something that usually Mexican is like the number one fastest growing, but this year it wasn't. It was like other world fusion flavors. Kind of they bundled it together. where do you see kind of the flavor palettes going?
Yeah, I think at least the way that I frame a lot of the stuff that I'm working with is I always find success in those global cuisines. I mean, it's whether it's Latin American, Asian, Mediterranean. I mean, those buckets tend to work really well, because even when a lot of the flavor forecast, you know, companies will distill down, like, here's like the one specific flavor, chances are it fits in one of those categories anyway. So you're kind of playing in the same arena. But I would say the one that I've noticed certainly for the last couple of years and can be found in, you know, across all of those is just that sweet spicy combination. I mean, we put out all kinds of information about swicey, like that was the, like, combining spicy, those two things together, and like that's kind of blown up into a thing. But I do think it's relevant. Like, I think that there's merit to that. People have been, and it's not like it's necessarily a unique thing. Like, people have been doing sweet and spicy combinations forever, but like suddenly now it's, you know, maybe because of social media, because of these other outlets, like it just gets more focus and play. But I'd say though, like, largely those are, that's kind of the category that we're seeing a lot of stuff in. A lot of asks are coming in for those types of flavors.
I was in we were in Tennessee, and I got like a shrimp and grits, and it was kind of sweet and spicy because they used some sort of, you know, obviously it's savory, but they added some sort of sugar or something to the grits, but then they coated the whole thing in sriracha, and I was like, this has got to be an interesting take.
Yeah,
amazing. Absolutely, yeah. Amazing. It was, yeah, exactly awesome. What I wanted. It, the grits gave me the sweetness, and then you got some heat behind it. And then as you took the next bite, it just kept rolling. And then eventually at the end, my mouth was on fire from the sriracha, but it was nonetheless,
yeah, sure,
quite delicious on a traditional Southern cuisine take, which I would have never guessed to put those technical flavors, especially it's like a sriracha, you know, a, you know, Asian style sauce into a Southern dish.
Yeah.
But again, it worked really well.
Yeah, I think you're seeing those marriages all over the place where, you know, people still want to be rooted in something authentic, and especially, you know, if the chef, you know, if that's their background and they want to pay homage to, you know, their family history or whatever, but then it's like they still want to make it their own and, you know, have this kind of unique play. So I love seeing those intersections of those flavors. And I'm laughing too, because like I'm thinking back to like even really early in my career as a developer, like we used to, I can't tell you how many formulas we would have where, like, I mean, it was a savory product. But you'd say, hey, I'm just like missing a little something. And somebody would suggest, just put like a little bit of sugar in it. And you're like, what, really? Like, this is a very savory, you know, application. And it's like, yep, like, just trust me, like, try it and see what happens. And then all of a sudden it would go from this, like, oh, this is pretty good, to, oh my gosh, like, I can't, like, I just want more. Mm-hmm. So it's like maybe been a not so secret that, like, a little bit of sweet with your savory and spicy, like, just makes it a little bit more craveable. So
I always go back to the Frosty and Fries, as I did that when I
was,
you know, for teenager. Sure. I was, yep. Anyone that looks at me crazy, I'm like, just get Wendy's fries. I don't know why it's Wendy's, but Wendy's fries and the chocolate Frosty, and you will know exactly 100%. What that marriage is like. Even my kids, because I think I did it in front of them, and they were like, Dad, what are you doing? And I was like, just try it. And now anytime there's a chocolate shake involved, they're dipping their french fries into it.
Absolutely. Mind blown. Because, I mean, that one's perfect because it's like fat, sugar, salt. And then you also have the hot cold dynamic. So like that's kind of cool too. So that's, yeah, I think that hits on just about everything.
So you mentioned just a minute ago about a spice report or a flavor report. What is that?
Oh, I think I said flavor forecast.
Yes, a flavor forecast. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, different companies approach it a little bit differently, but it's something, you know, we work with all different vendors, you know, for ingredient suppliers, and it's pretty, I would say it's pretty common for like the bigger ones especially to publish some kind of thing every year that just kind of predicts where they think flavors are going. You have like some of the bigger trend report companies too, like Data Central, Technomics, like they'll talk about flavors and try to predict what's going to be big and when it's going to be big. They kind of track, and I forget all the different nomenclature, but it's like, you know, it'll start out as kind of just emerging, like it's up and coming. Like you might see this on, you know, some real high end fine dining restaurant menus, like yuzu was this like years ago. Even sriracha was this like years ago. And sriracha is maybe a good example because it went from that sort of like, hey, we're seeing it in a couple places, to now it's practically ubiquitous. Like you see sriracha everywhere. You see sriracha on menus from, it could be fine dining, it could be QSR and everything in between. So once it gets to that point and it's pretty mainstream, like it just follows along this track, and they publish, you know, this information, try to help industry folks like figure out where those targets might be for customers. So
how often are they right and how often are they wrong?
Well, that's a good question. I'm not sure how much anybody really goes back and says like, hey, you said this was going to be the flavor in 3 years and it turned out not to be. But I would say it's mostly on point. I mean, I think especially if you live in the middle section, if you looked at it like a bell curve, I would say if you're playing as a developer, if you're playing in this like real up and coming, you know, cutting edge, you're not going to have a lot of success developing products because the flavors just aren't really known to people. And then once you get to the other side of the bell curve, it's like those, when a flavor has become mainstream and ubiquitous, it stops being interesting, or as interesting, I should say. So like you kind of, I feel like you want to live in this middle space, and it's hard to say that you're, you know, right or wrong in that, because it's there's so much to choose from and it's so many different variables, and like you don't really know what's going to take that flavor that might live in the middle and, you know, propel it to being the thing that's you know, now the hot and mainstream thing. But
what do you have a claim to fame, like an innovation that you're like, yes, it went through, even if nobody even knew about it, but you know, because you're so behind the scenes, it's not like it's like Chris came out with this awesome, and it doesn't have to be, you know, Breakpoint, it could be with any of your companies, but do you have like that one claim to fame you're like, that was me, I was behind that?
Yeah, this is going to be funny, especially to any of my colleagues from Breakpoint that are going to listen to this. There was a product that I developed, and it was before I was with Breakpoint. So Breakpoint used to be my customer when I worked for a flavor company, and I worked in, you know, different meat systems and all kinds of stuff. And I remember that they came to us looking for some opportunities for dark meat chicken, because it's the U.S. People don't like dark meat, unfortunately. So they had, you know, hey, we got a lot of dark meat to work with. Like, what can we do with it? And I developed a product for them. So I remember they came in and I was all excited because I got to show them this product. Basically made, I guess what a lot of people have now come to call a chick rib. So I took a bone-in chicken thigh and then just cut along either side of the bone to make like a piece, you know, like something like this that kind of resembled a pork rib. And you had the bone inside, and I marinated it like with kind of a barbecue, you know, seasoning with tons of like mesquite smoke and spices, grilled it. And then it just like gave you the same eating experience of a rib. And I was so passionate about this. They ended up loving it, and Breakpoint did commercialize that product. So when I joined Breakpoint, it was still in the portfolio. It was still on the POS materials. You could still buy it. It has since been discontinued, and my heart is broken. It just continues to be a little bit of a running joke. And in fact, last week we celebrated my 5-year anniversary with the company, and for the group picture, three of us held up a picture of the, and they were called thigh bones was the marketing term for them. We all held up a picture of them and just made like a sad face and just had
fun. That's awesome.
Yeah. So like, that's the thing everybody knows. Cause like it was my baby. I absolutely loved it, and now it's gone. But
hey,
it had its run. I mean, it was okay.
Nothing can last forever. And you know, anything that's that fair big, enough, you know, has probably been created and been around for quite some time anyways. Where do you see, you know, automation, AI? I don't know if you're a big tech AI type person. I know I am. I use it all the time in everything that I do to educate me as well as help guide me, because like I don't have the background that a lot of chefs have, or kind of that sciencey background, but a lot of what I've been doing, again, especially in the dry aging space, has happened to been trying to figure stuff out, and there's information, but it's not as readily available as you would think. And so I use a lot of AI. So what are your thoughts on that sector?
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly seen the impact that it's had in a short period of time. I'll be fully honest and say that I am nowhere near probably where I should be in utilizing it. I know I have, you know, chef friends that use this in their product development efforts and can actually, you know, give it a prompt and come up with a complete rendering and an idea of what a concept could look like before it, you know, it ever becomes a reality. I think that's super intriguing because that's often a struggle that we have when we're developing something new is like, how do you convey that to a customer or a potential customer? Like, what would this thing look like in real life? And so that's, I think that's an amazing opportunity. We've explored it a little bit. We've had a couple of companies contact us, and like from a strict R&D standpoint, I'm not sure that we saw exactly where it could fit for us today. Cause it was, I would say it was primarily focused on like just phishing information or phishing for information out on the internet. So it was just collating, like we were giving it prompts to like what a new product could be. And it was giving us like patent information about like equipment and things that it, so like it just didn't quite like connect mm-hmm. for us. I imagine that we'll get to a point where it will, and we'll probably have to start leveraging that a lot more, but yeah, I'd say we're probably not quite there yet.
Okay, let's switch to because this one you should be able to, or you have probably some insight, lab grown or cultured beets. I mean, that's been kind of a thing that's been a hot topic as of late. You know, Florida had their thing where they banned it or they're not allowing it. You know, what is your overall thought on that, on lab?
Yeah, I mean, I'm probably going to be a bit of a purist in that regard, just, you know, as I work for a meat processor. I think it's interesting. I remember a couple of years ago, it was some convention or something we were at where they had like a lab cultured product to try. And it was like, yeah, I mean, like you can, I know it's like the real thing, but like, it's not the real thing. And, kind of tough to wrap my head around that one, but, yeah, I'll probably be a little old school and purist on that one. And, you know, kind of want to stick to more traditional methods, but, I definitely appreciate the ingenuity, the insight, you know, the innovation behind it, but, I don't know if I'll jump on board quite yet.
I mean, you don't want your steak that was, grown in the petri dish for 6 months or whatever it might be.
Yeah, I might hold off and, you know, see what the data says first. But
right, exactly. Yeah. One of those. I think I'm there with you. I think I'll wait until some more data comes out to
yes,
thorough decision on what to do with it. You know, what advice would you give to young professionals? I know you said there's now like these new culinary classes, or they're coming out with degrees, culinologists, but what would you give someone kind of breaking in the industry? I'm always trying to give young culinarians, you know, I want to show them what's available out there. You know, again, I don't want people pigeonholed into, they've got to work this brutal, you know, 14-hour shift in a restaurant. I'm not saying it doesn't have its place. I mean, you got to have people to do that work, you know, and that's why there are successful restaurants. But what advice would you give to those young culinarians coming into the space, whether it be from education, experiences like you did? What's your advice?
Yeah, I mean, it's such an interesting conversation to have, because I think a lot of people have a lot of different opinions, you know, and there are times I recognize, you know, my path was a little bit different, and, you know, I suffer from imposter syndrome every once in a while. Like, yeah, I'm not like a real chef. Like, I didn't do all that stuff. And, I think number one, like if you follow your heart and where your passion lies, like you're probably not going to be steered wrong. But, I think the more you can learn, the better, for sure. And that kind of applies to just about anything. But I would pretty safely say that the way the direction the industry is headed, I think the more you can the more you can bolster yourself in understanding, like if you want to get on this side of the industry. So I guess I should preface that by saying first, this side of the industry exists because there are a lot of people that don't even know that. Mm-hmm. To your point, like you think, okay, I went to culinary school. So now like, okay, what restaurant am I going to work in? There is opportunity beyond that if you're, you know, if your goals and aspirations take you there. So first, like there are other opportunities out there. And I would say, if you've been a traditionally culinary minded person, you know, get as much food science knowledge and experience as you can. And whether that's finding a degree program that offers you both or, you know, getting a second degree, I mean, whatever people, you know, have to carve their path and figure out what works for them. But to my earlier point, like I think that I have been successful doing what I do as a culinarian because I had the food science background to back it up. And I will always support that. I will always push that. It's even when I hired in the culinologist that works for us, I would say for the first 6 months, I probably had her dedicated mostly to just straight R&D projects because I think it's so important that she understood, you know, where does the food science apply in what we do specifically, understanding our processes and our procedures and our equipment and the things that we make before we start getting into like, how are we going to cook stuff? How are we going to make it look good? You know, you got to know where it comes from and how it got there and all that stuff. So I think the more that you can kind of tie that together, I think as we go forward in the industry, the better served you're going to be just having that more broad and dynamic background for sure.
Yeah, I have to agree with you 100%. I know it helped me when I was doing front of house positions, GM type stuff. Having a culinary background made it so much easier to then work with, you know, if I had a chef to work because I could speak the same language. I could have, you know, and I knew what was going on both sides of the coin versus just, I don't know, that's what they said. So I have to listen to them because I don't know any better. And then as as I learned, you know, kind of that front of house mentality and marketing and displaying stuff, you know, I understood why they thought the way they did. And to your point, don't be a one trick pony. Learn as much as you can. Even if you are the cook in the back of the house, go find out why the servers do what they do or the front of house manager does what they do. Or again, reach out, talk to corporate chefs. I have so many corporate chef friends now that they do so many unique, whether it be, like you said, from an ingredient supplier or a manufacturer or a equipment. They do so many different things in so many ways, and people just don't even understand that that's a real job. And it can be pretty rewarding, and from, you know, your mental health, and from, you know, at least for me, I always say I got lucky. I got really lucky in how I landed in the industry, and, you know, I kind of veered off pretty quick. Within a year and a half, I got out of the traditional restaurant because I was like, holy crap. This is going to be taxing on my body. I can't go 12 hours a day, go out at night, wake up and rinse and repeat. But actually getting a chance to have a family and do the things that I want to do, it's just so much more rewarding, you know, and knowing. And again, that's not for everybody. But if it is, know that it's out there and it just gives you more, can give you more clarity to your life and your purpose. Because I think a lot of culinarians, they get into a restaurant and they get their butts beat. And the next thing you know, they might have gotten to that exec sous chef or whatever spot they're going for. And then they kind of look back and go, why was that what I really wanted to do? Was that all life was meant, you know?
Yep. No, 100%. I mean, I was the same where like I spent time in the restaurants and I recognized like, this isn't a job. It's not even just a career. Like this is a lifestyle. And I don't want to do anything if I'm not going to commit 110% to that. And I think I just recognized pretty quickly, like, I can't be the best at this because like, this is just, I'm not willing to do all this. And like, there are people who are just wired and designed a little bit differently who are going to thrive at that and be super successful. And I love those people for that. And I'm so appreciative that they exist because we wouldn't get to do a lot of what we do if they didn't. But I know that's not me. And that's when I started kind of looking at like, what else could I do with this? But I always say like, I have known a lot of chefs that ended up on our side of the industry that came from, you know, crazy restaurant backgrounds. They all will say the same thing. Like they are so grateful. They're happy that they kind of got a life back. I have seen many go that direction. I have yet to see one that goes back. And it's crazy because so many of them will, you know, you share stories like, man, sometimes I just miss being on the line. I miss the chaos. I miss the craziness, the camaraderie, like all of that stuff. But like, I'm never going to go back and do it. So they're great memories. And it's just, yeah, like once people get on this side of the food industry and just see how amazing it is, like, it's just, yeah, I'm very blessed and very fortunate to have gotten where I am today for sure.
Yeah, I'm the same. There's some days where it's like, man, it'd be great to get my ass kicked on a Friday night, but like one time, not every day, one night. And I think that's why a lot of us will do catering events or help out friends that are in the industry, because it scratches the itch of, I got to just get dirty and I just got to cook and just be pots and pans slamming and you know, communicating back and forth. I know it's what I'll do when it comes down to it and someone asks, like, absolutely, let's do it, you know, on a Friday night event or a Saturday night event, because I know it's a one-off and I'm going to do this once every quarter or maybe once a year even, but it's just enough that it reminds me to stay on this side, because there's so much more to life than just cooking and your career.
Yeah, 100%. I love it. Like, I'll do that too. We'll get a kind of a one-off ask from somebody and it's like, yeah, I want to do that. And I want to do that one time. And then I'm going to take a break. So like, it scratches the itch. And then you're like, yep, I remember exactly why this is not a thing anymore. But
100%. So Chef, you are an amazing person. Where do people go if they want to learn more about you, about Breakbush, anything in general?
Yeah. I mean, Breakbush, you can go check out the Breakbush website, literally just breakbush.com. Me personally, I'm not a huge social media. I'm a social media, like, oh, I don't want to say stalker, but like a lurker.
Connoisseur. You're a connoisseur.
Yeah. I'm a lurker and I consume content. I love to see what people are doing out there. But I would say I largely stay away from a lot of engagement, because it's just, it can consume you. But
it can. Yeah. It can, but I challenge you with what you do. Give some behind the scenes. Give some background to what you do to this industry, because it's super fascinating when I do find a chef that posts. And it's not, don't let it consume you. Post one thing a week, maybe one thing every 2 weeks, but just it shows enough to be, for culinarians to go, oh, it's more than just fancy plates. Because I think there's a few more unicorns or people like us that are a little outside the box that want to do something different, but there's just there's nothing to visualize that, and so they default to what they see and what they know. So I challenge you to maybe post, you know, here or there, just do an Instagram, and all it is just a quick picture with a caption. You'd be surprised at how many people will relate to that.
That's awesome. Actually, I appreciate that, because it's something that we've talked about too. Like, is there something we can do? Just to kind of engage people differently from the culinary side. So I appreciate you saying that, and I will absolutely take that to heart. And I'll be sure to tag you in whatever the first post is.
Yes, absolutely. If you need help, advice, tips, tricks, I've immersed myself with starting this podcast and figured it all out the hard way. I wouldn't want anyone to do it, but I really appreciate your time. I know you're crazy busy. So again, thanks again, Chef. And for everybody watching, we'll catch you next time on the Sunny Side.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
HospitalityChain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, HospitalityChain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace.